for inviting me to this incredible conference. It's wonderful to see all the amazing initiatives that Penn State's taken to really stem the abuse of children. And I feel particularly honored to be part of the incredible other presenters that are here. So thank you for that. So when I first talked to Doug about what I was going to be presenting and realized I had a half an hour to speak, I knew I was in trouble. So we'll do our best to get through this, but just to kind of look generally at the goals, I was going to very briefly look at the literature on the sequelae of maltreatment with a focus on the early years of life and really highlighting attachment, because that's what really informs a lot of the intervention that I'll be talking about. To talk a bit about a developmental psychopathology framework, to present some of our illustrative work on randomized controlled trials for preventing and treating child maltreatment, to highlight translational research, and then, if time allows, to touch a bit on policy implications and future directions. So you can see I have a very large agenda in mind here. But I think, as we've already heard today, parents with a history of childhood maltreatment are much more likely to demonstrate poor parenting practices and to, unfortunately, maltreat their own children, thus sustaining a cycle of abuse and neglect. I think the good news is that that does not always have to happen, and we do see parents that are resilient themselves despite histories of maltreatment, and that's particularly the case if they're able to have supportive relationships in their lives, including receiving evidence-based prevention and intervention strategies. We know that maltreatment really affects an array of issues in child development, including things like emotion regulation and expression, insecure attachment, negative self-development, and negative associations of representations of relationships, poor symbolic development and moral development. And once these young kids hit the school age years, we see difficulties both with peer relationships and also with their overall school achievement and adaptation. Unfortunately, that all too often results in these children entering the criminal justice system and themselves getting into abusive relationships and ultimately perpetuating maltreatment with their children. Increasingly in recent years, we've also learned a lot more about the neurobiological sequelae of maltreatment, looking at things like brain structure and function. A lot of the work that we've done at Mount Hope Family Center has looked at stress hormones, HPA axis regulation, and we also know that maltreatment affects systems that regulate norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, and glucocorticoids. That could be a whole talk in and of itself, so I just wanted to highlight that. Much of my work and the work of my colleagues has been guided by a developmental psychopathology framework. And briefly, it really focuses on the interplay between normal development and atypical development. And I think one of the really positive things about a developmental psychopathology approach is that it maintains that really at any given point in one's lifespan, you can engage a more positive trajectory, or if you've been doing well, you could also engage a negative developmental trajectory. In a lot of our intervention research, we find that actually developmental transitions are really important windows of opportunity to be able to get in there and intervene. And so that's really important to keep in mind. I also like to highlight that developmental psychopathology is not limited to children, but it's really a lifespan perspective. I think often people think that it's just in the early years of life, and really that's not the case, although a lot of the research has focused on children. Increasingly, we're looking to look at the transition into adulthood, which is also particularly important when you think about intergenerational transmission. So basically, how can a developmental psychopathology approach inform prevention and intervention? Well, basically, if we're conducting research on intervention and we find that a particular stage salient issue, if it's righted, that results in a positive developmental outcome, then that's implicated as a mechanism in the development of psychopathology. So we can really target that. and learn more about that. And we also have found that research on resilience is critically important, because if we can identify processes by which children who have been exposed to adversity actually are able to do well despite that adversity, and look at what issues they have within them or externally to them that allow them to succeed, we can then build those in actually to our preventive interventions and our treatment strategies. One question that might come up is, a lot of our work has focused on relationally based interventions. And one can argue, well, why do you need a relational intervention? Why might you not just teach parenting skills, focus really on the parents? And in years of, it's hard to believe, I'd say almost 30 years at Mount Hope, conducting both research, basic research, as well as intervention research, and providing intervention, I came to the realization that we had parents that we were teaching parenting class after parenting class to, and I started thinking they could probably teach the parenting class, but they weren't necessarily being able to implement what they were learning with their children. So I thought we really needed to do more than just teach parent skills training. And basically, we also know that when parents have themselves sustained insensitive care during their own childhoods, that they really often develop representational models of themselves, of their children, of other significant others, that really get in the way of them being able to really effectively implement what they know. Just a bit about attachment, because I think this is a really incredibly knowledgeable audience, and my colleague Jody told me I had to get rid of all my attachment slides. But basically, we know that attachment is to ensure survival, to regulate closeness and distance with the primary caregiver, and to increase the child's felt security. And we know, obviously, the criticality of that early positive caregiving and the probability that that will result in secure attachment in children. And conversely, if they've had insensitive care, they're much less likely to be able to feel good about themselves and to develop positive relationships in their lives. We also know that attachment is an evolutionary emotional tie. The infants are biologically predisposed to form attachments, and that attachment behaviors, I think it's important to keep in mind that they can be adaptive in a given situation, but that then they can become maladaptive in another situation. One example that always comes to mind is if you have a young child in an abusive home, they might learn that it's really important to shut down emotionally and to really avoid their caregivers. When those young kids then enter the school arena and they feel that they can't trust their teachers, they don't reach out to their teachers, they have difficulty forming peer relationships because of the avoidance, that's when it becomes much more maladaptive. So why does attachment matter? It provides a framework for future relationships. We know that insecure attachment ships are linked with many problems in later childhood and adulthood, and we know that secure attachments are really related with positive developmental attainments. I think Laura touched on this. I think our data are pretty consistent, seeing that in children who have been maltreated, there are rates of insecure attachment as high as close to 90%. And that the majority of those insecure attachments are of a type called disorganized, which really tends to bode really pretty poorly for future development. We also have found, and a lot of work was this, that actually Duncan Cicchetti originated back in his days at Harvard, that when you have a maltreated child with an insecure attachment relationship, those relationships tend to be stable. So they start out insecure and they continue to be insecure minus some positive intervening variable. Whereas if the small percentage of maltreated children that you see who have secure attachments, that if you follow those children over time, those secure attachments actually become insecure. Again, I think really highlighting the criticality of prevention in those situations. There are a number of attachment theory-informed interventions out there, in addition to what we've been doing at Mount Hope Family Center. some of the early work of Byron Eglund and Martha Erickson, the STEEP project, Bill Marvin's Circle of Security that is more of a group intervention. Mary Dozier and Phil Fisher have done a lot of work with children in foster care. Mary's intervention is particularly interesting because it's very short term. I believe it's an 8-week intervention where she actually intervenes with foster parents and the children in their care, and has gotten some really great findings, both with respect to improved attachment security and also HPA access regulation, which we're finding as well. So there's some consistency coming out in that. What I want to focus on a bit today is one of the relational interventions called child-parent psychotherapy. And it sounds kind of like a fancy term, and everybody says, what does it really mean? Hopefully I'll give you a bit of an understanding. I usually try to show some video clips, but for the sake of time, I didn't want to do that today. But it is a relationship-based form of intervention that focuses on the parent-child interaction within a dyadic format. So you actually work with the caregiver and the child together. It can be provided to children really from birth to age 5. That's basically the developmental period. And the theoretical target of child-parent psychotherapy, you can really kind of envision a triangle where you have the young child at one apex, the caregiver at another, and the therapist at another. And you're really looking at the transactions and the web of interactions that occur among those dyads. A real challenge with child-parent psychotherapy is you're really dividing your attention between the caregiver and the child. And in cases with young parents who have themselves had significant histories of trauma, that can be a tricky balance. And often, early on, you have to spend a bit more time working with the caregiver. I'll probably slip into saying mothers a lot, because that's a lot of the work that we've done, but it's certainly a model of therapy that is equally applicable to fathers. I think that's a recommendation I have, that we really need to work harder and harder to get fathers involved in these interventions. We've used it with grandparents, really whoever the primary caregiver is. And we've done it with moms, dads, and more than one child. So it's really very flexible in many ways, though very challenging as well. Child-parent psychotherapy is basically rooted in psychodynamic theory. It has its origins in the work of Selma Freiberg, who wrote a lovely book called Ghosts in the Nursery, basically arguing that when a parent has had themselves a negative history of caregiving, that when they have a child, it's likely, if not deterministic, that that early history of theirs will be perpetuated onto their young child because they haven't experienced anything different. More recently, Alicia Lieberman wrote a lovely article with her colleagues called Angels in the Nursery, and basically also maintaining that when you have parents who, even in the midst of trauma, have had some positive caregiving experiences, that those experiences also can be carried forward and built on in a positive way. As I mentioned, you're really working with the parent-child dyad together and looking at how you can help the caregiver not generalize negative representations onto that relationship with their young child. It's basically non-didactic, so we're not teaching, we're not lecturing, we're certainly providing developmental guidance as need be. A lot of the families that we work with who have themselves had significant histories of trauma don't even know how to play with their baby. So you'll sit down on the floor with them and just really try to help them start learning how to play. I always use an example where you can have a mom who will be, you know, rolling a ball back and forth with her baby, and then all of a sudden she takes the ball away and is kind of teasing the baby. The baby will start crying, and the mom will say something like, oh, that's how he always is. He's always crying at home. And trying to gradually help the mom understand that, well, gee, he seemed really happy and you guys were doing great. What do you think might have happened to have that baby start crying? The first time you say that, you're probably going to get nowhere. But if you start seeing patterns like that over time, you can start intervening and making some headway in that direction. So what predicts whether the parent's past will be repeated with their child? Obviously, the whole theme of intergenerational transmission. I think our research, as well as a lot of others in the field, shows that if a parent can look back at their own childhood and really remember it as being negative and remember it in an open, angry kind of way, that they're more receptive to intervention and less likely to want to perpetrate a negative caregiving experience with their child. I think some of our more challenging cases are when we have a parent come in and basically say, well, I was whooped as a child and it never hurt me, and look how well I turned out. Very different from, I think, Laura, who was mentioning that when you have a parent who so does not want to repeat their negative caregiving. So it's more challenging when you have the former, but I would argue it's still possible. And also remembering the trauma that the parent has experienced really allows them more to identify with their child versus to identify with the aggressor, and again, thereby being less likely to perpetuate the negative caregiving. We've done a number of preventive interventions at Mount Hope Family Center, funding from the National Institute of Mental Health. I'm going to highlight one. Today, we actually compared two different forms of therapy. We compared child-parent psychotherapy, which is the attachment theory-informed intervention, and we compared it with more of a psychoeducational parenting intervention, which was very much more didactic in nature, trying to teach parenting, and did not have the child present in that particular form of intervention. Both of the models of intervention were home-based, which I really have a bias very strongly in favor of, because I think when we work with these families that are in very impoverished neighborhoods that are in high crime, it's difficult for them to actually get into a center, to feel comfortable in that. A lot of our populations are very much minority populations, and so having them come to the office just increases that sense of distance, I think, between the service provider and the parent. So a lot of our work is home-based, and these particular interventions were. We had a number of, we actually had four groups. We had the parenting intervention, we had the child-parent psychotherapy, we had a non-maltreated comparison group, which we also built into a lot of our intervention research, because in addition to seeing if we can increase positive things and decrease negative things in our treatment groups, we want to see if we can actually approximate the functioning in a group of youngsters that did not have any maltreatment whatsoever, or at least any detected maltreatment. And then we had what we called a community standard group, and a number of presenters today talked about how unfortunately that can be nothing in many cases. So we can have children who are identified as maltreated, who are officially reported and indicated, and they're offered intervention, but we're not necessarily seeing if that's happening at all. So our community standard group ranged from pretty much nothing to actually receiving some form of intervention. We basically, our design was basically from age 1 to age 3. We did a pre-assessment, a mid-assessment, a post, and then a 1 year post-intervention. And this is basically these first, anyway, the first three bars show the three groups of maltreated children. The first is the child-parent psychotherapy, the second is the psychoed, the third is the community standard, and the fourth is the non-maltreated comparison group, and it's just showing the rates of security. You can see even in the non-maltreated group, the rate of security is really pretty low. It's about 40%, which is much lower than what you would expect in a normative sample. You'd expect more like 60, 70% maybe. And that just highlights what a high-risk group even our non-maltreated identified group was. This is one of my favorite slides because after our 1 year intervention, you can see that both the child parent psychotherapy and the psychoeducational home visitation model increased dramatically with respect to secure attachment. And you can see that the community standard basically did nothing. These are all statistically significant results. And the non-maltreated comparison group pretty much stayed right where it was. We were surprised that the two active intervention groups were equally effective in promoting secure attachment, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, because I would have expected that the child-parent psychotherapy would have been more effective than the educational model. This next slide is similar. This just shows the rates of disorganization in all of the groups. Again, you can see disorganized attachment was very high at the end of the intervention. Again, the first two active interventions decreased significantly. Again, I think somewhat of a surprise. I think this was one of the first interventions, attachment theory-informed interventions with this maltreated population of infants to show that you could actually improve attachment security and decrease disorganized attachment. We then did a 1 year follow-up, and this is really neat. I didn't animate this one. I'm glad my animation was working. But you can see the four bars were baseline, post, and then 1 year post. And interestingly in this, the only intervention that resulted in sustained security of attachment was the child-parent psychotherapy attachment-informed intervention. So I was really pretty excited because that validated what I expected might happen, that when you teach parenting skills, you might be teaching for a particular developmental level, but we can't necessarily be sure that that's going to generalize over time. So my takeaway message from that was early on, maybe any good intervention is good enough, and that you're going to result in some improved attachment security, but over time, if you want your sustained effects, you might have to be more focused in what you're doing. We also looked at the relation between intervention, attachment security, and behavior problems. For this particular slide, we combined the two active interventions, and we found that those who had secure attachment had fewer behavior problems. That was a self-report child behavior checklist, not self-report parent report. Another thing that we looked at in this particular intervention was normalization of cortisol, and we found that although at baseline the groups did not differ in their AM stress hormone cortisol level, by mid-intervention there was a divergence with both child-parent psychotherapy, the home-based parenting intervention being comparable to the non-maltreated comparison, and with the community standard group evidencing lower levels, so kind of still hypocortisolism. More recently, and this is cutting edge, and I really attribute all of this to Dante Cicchetti, so don't ask me too many questions about it, but we have started looking at some genetic moderation, and in a really interesting study, I believe it came out in 2006, looking at the serotonin transporter linked promoter region and the dopamine receptor genes, we found that in the maltreated children, the genetic makeup did not relate to attachment security, but in the non-maltreated children, it did. So that's kind of a really interesting emergent finding, that if maltreatment is perhaps such an incredibly powerful stressor, that the genetic makeup is not as significant as it is in these kids who were not maltreated. So just summary of the treatment outcomes, we did find that evidence-based treatments derived from attachment theory are available to children who have been maltreated, that they actually can prevent negative sequelae, particularly with respect to promoting secure attachment. We're getting some findings on the normalization of cortisol as a function of intervention. That's also consistent with findings from Phil Fisher's lab and Mary Dozier's lab. And importantly, the negative effects of maltreatment really are mutable, and there is plasticity of attachment, which I think was pretty exciting. So what do you do then? You say, great, we have some of these really good RCTs, and do we want to keep them buried in academic journals, or do we really want to try to get them out there more broadly to the populations that need them, to try to get therapists trained in the evidence-based models? And that's what we've really been focusing on a lot as part of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network. I want to tell you a little bit about one of our initiatives called Building Healthy Children. This was a quote by Frederick Douglass: "It is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." This was a really kind of exciting initiative because it was funded by our local Monroe County Department of Human Services and by the United Way of Greater Rochester. And since about 2007, they've been providing about over $1 million a year in funding for this project. We've served over 350 kids at this point. And I actually called Dante the day that we got this grant, and I said, we actually got policy change, because after all these years, people are willing to pay for research and to let us actually randomize. And that was a huge, huge step, because in the early years, randomization was really a dirty word. So Building Healthy Children basically targets moms who had their first child prior to the age of 21, who are residing in poverty, so they're all TANF eligible. We've recruited them through a number of pediatrics departments in the Rochester area. And what's amazing is the risk factors in these families. And again, the only criteria we were looking for was basically living in poverty and having your first child prior to the age of 21 and not yet having been reported to Child Protective Services. So these were families who had no maltreatment perpetrated on their children. We found that 46% of these young moms have domestic violence in their current relationships. Close to 30% have significant depressive symptoms. 18% have a current or past criminal history. 37% had an indicated child maltreatment report on themselves as a child. And 20% had reported a history of sexual abuse. So if we're thinking about preventing intergenerational transmission, that's, I think, some pretty powerful statistics. We really conceptualize Building Healthy Children as a service pyramid. At the very base of the pyramid, we have paraprofessional outreach, and every single young mom is assigned a paraprofessional worker who deals with meeting their basic needs, trying to ensure stable housing. You know, thinking about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if we can't get some of those basic needs met and felt safety, all the intervention in the world isn't going to do anything. Our second tier is an evidence-based model of parents as teachers, which is a more didactic parent skills training. We then have child parent psychotherapy for those moms who have definitely been in domestic violence situations, are having more difficulty very early on with their children. And then we also offer interpersonal psychotherapy for those moms who are experiencing depression. We're getting some really cool results to date. We had a recent article published in Pediatrics. We're finding, and interestingly, we're finding these results in the mothers who had the most significant needs. So the moms who were actually receiving the child parent psychotherapy and the interpersonal psychotherapy for depression. So we're getting decreased depression, decreased parental rigidity, decreased child abuse potential, decreased difficulty in social relationships and perceived loneliness. We're getting some interesting health outcomes for the kids, including higher rates of well baby visits and immunizations, more emotional stability, and increased social support from their families. In terms of policy implications, I think that we increasingly know that evidence-based interventions, not just ours, but certainly others, and I know many of which you're going to be hearing about tomorrow from Judith Cohen and Tony Manarino, that we know there are evidence-based things out there that work, and we just need to be doing them. We need to really, I think, consider upfront when we're developing these RCTs, we need to think about what to build into them so that they're going to be more likely to resonate to the policymakers that are making funding decisions. If they can't understand what we're talking about, it's going to have very little impact. In fact, I was just at a presentation with someone from NYU, and she said about 2% of any of the research that we're all doing actually makes it into the policy arena. So we really need to work at getting better with that. And we really need to do broader dissemination. In terms of future directions, I think that studies that have been informed by a developmental psychopathology approach have been too focused on early childhood, and we need to really look at the period between adolescence and adulthood more and more. We really need more and more multi-level investigations where we're not separating out socio-emotional development from neurobiological development, but really trying to integrate those. That's a lot of what we're doing at Mount Hope Family Center, and finding some real interesting things with genetic moderation of intervention outcome. We really need to work on increasing our dissemination of evidence-based models and moving it to the community, and then really trying to get some funding to do effectiveness studies to make sure that what worked in a university lab is actually going to work in the communities where we all live and provide services. I think some of the resistance to uptake on evidence-based models is people look at you and they say, well, you know, you did it with somebody who had a vanilla depression, but you didn't do it with somebody who had depression, a personality disorder, and PTSD. So we need to really be doing more of that. And we also need more work on studies of the sequelae of maltreatment and intervention with more middle-income and upper-income families. I think that's a real gap in the literature as well. And I'd just like to end with this slide. The gap between what we know and what we do is lethal. Kay Redfield Jamison, because we know more and more, and we just need to be sure we're doing it. Thanks to my collaborators, Dante Cicchetti, Fred Rogosh, Jenny Manley, and all of the kids' families, therapists, and numerous research assistants and graduate students over the years. This work definitely does take a village. Thank you.